Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 13, lucky number 13. And for this episode of The Bloody Pit, I've decided to, once again, delve into the old-time radio area that I love so much and that so few of you seem to enjoy as much as I do. And that's okay. I hope to use this forum to introduce more people to old-time radio. Not just the horror stuff, but other stuff as well. Although, I have concentrated heavily on the horror stuff for, well, obvious reasons. Anyway, 13th episode of The Bloody Pit, we're going to focus on a singular piece of old-time radio. Not that old, considering that this stuff dates back to the 20s and 30s. This is from the 1960s, but wait, before I get too far into this, let me explain. This will take some explanation. Okay, first off, I have talked about M.R. James, Montague Rhodes James, before on the podcast when I introduced an adaptation, a radio adaptation of his stuff back in October of last year. But for those of you who are not aware of who M.R. James was, he was an English author, a medieval scholar, and the provost of King's College, Cambridge, and of Eton College at different times in his life. He's best remembered for his ghost stories, which is, of course, why I'm a big fan. They're regarded as among the best in the genre, and that is for good reason. James redefined the ghost story for the new century, that is the 20th century, of course, by abandoning many of the formal gothic cliches of his predecessors and using more realistic contemporary settings. However, James's protagonists and plots tend to reflect his own antiquarian interests. It's very easy to draw a straight line between the personage of M.R. James and a lot of his main characters, or even just sometimes the secondary characters, in a lot of his stories. Now, although James is best known these days for his ghost stories, he was also a medieval scholar, and he put out a lot of written work in scholarly circles about this stuff, and he's still well-regarded in those circles. Indeed, the success of his stories was kind of founded on his antiquarian talents and his knowledge. They often fueled or suggested the plot lines or some of the odder twists and turns of most of his fantastic stories. Now, James's ghost stories were published in a series of collections, Ghost Stories of an Antiquarian in 1904, More Ghost Stories of an Antiquarian in 1911, A Thin Ghost and Other Stories in 1919, and A Warning to the Curious and Other Ghost Stories in 1925. Many of his tales were written as Christmas Eve entertainments to be read aloud to friends. Later on, of course, here just a few years ago, this idea was used by the BBC when they filmed Christopher Lee reading four of James's short stories in a candlelit room in King's College. If you can get your hands on that to see, it shouldn't be too hard to find. Out there. I don't know of a DVD release, but if you have to, just employ the special antenna. Just look up Christopher Lee and M.R. James and you'll probably run across it. Those are really neat. They consist of Christopher Lee essentially kind of narrating partially filmed versions of some of the nicer, more interesting ghost stories of M.R. James. My favorite of those that he did in that setting would be The Ash Tree. That's a really fantastic adaptation of that particular story. Now, I love M.R. James' stories, and I came to them through film, of course, through the adaptation of his story, The Casting of the Runes, in 1958 called Curse of the Demon or Night of the Demon. But one of the great things about that is it's a good indicator of what you're going to find in a lot of Jamesian short stories, or a lot of M.R. James's straight-out short stories, of ghosts and horror. What's great is almost all of his stories usually include a number of specific elements. There's an interesting setting in an English village or a seaside town or a country estate. Sometimes it involves an old abbey or a church, oftentimes a library or a university. There's a nondescript and rather naive gentleman scholar as a protagonist a lot of the time, and that's the character that you can sometimes think of as the author inserting himself into the story. The stories usually involve the discovery of an old book or some kind of antiquarian object that somehow unlocks or calls down to earth, or at least attracts the unwelcome attention of a supernatural menace, usually from beyond the grave. Now, according to James, a ghost story must put the reader into the position of saying to himself, if I'm not very careful, something of this kind may happen to me. He also perfected the technique of narrating supernatural events through implication and suggestion, letting his reader fill in the blanks and focusing on the mundane details of his settings and characters in order to throw the horrific and bizarre elements into greater relief. He summed up his approach in his foreword to the anthology Ghosts and Marvels in 1924. He said, quote, two ingredients most valuable in the concocting of a ghost story arc are, to me, the atmosphere and the nicely managed crescendo. Let us then be introduced to the actors in a placid way. Let us see them going about their ordinary business, undisturbed by forebodings, pleased with their surroundings, and into this calm environment let the ominous thing put out its head, unobtrusively at first, and then more insistently, until it holds the stage. He also noted, another requisite, in my opinion, is that the ghost should be malevolent or odious. Amiable and helpful apparitions are all very well in fairy tales or in local legends, but I have no use for them in a fictional ghost story. And with that, I can't agree. If they're not malevolent, or evil, or spiteful, or sinister, then you're not really dealing with a horror story. You're dealing with another kind of tale. Now, what brought this particular adaptation of a Jamesian story to my attention was, of all things, a podcast. Now, on my blog, The Bloody Pit of Rod, I have noted before that there is this wonderful podcast out there called A Podcast to the Curious, which is, of course, a play on one of the greatest of all M.R. James short stories. And A Podcast to the Curious is, I'll let them put it in their words. It is the only podcast dedicated to the weird fiction of M.R. James. Each episode, your humble host, Will Ross and Mike Taylor, tackle a different M.R. James story, providing a commentary on the story and discussing its themes and form, interlaced with readings from the story. Along the way, they include discussion on stage, screen, and radio adaptations of the stories, information on James's life and interests, as well as on the legions of authors who were inspired by him. If you are at all interested in M.R. James, let me suggest that you check out their podcast. It's very entertaining, incredibly enlightening, and as both the hosts are academics, they really are able to bring to bear some fascinating information that they can get from delving deeply into the subject at a scholarly level that I just don't have the time for, or really sometimes the inclination. Their ability to also get interviews with people who are other academics interested in M.R. James, doing research into his life and work, and talking to filmmakers and other creative people who are working with M.R. James's stuff these days, is phenomenal. A Podcast to the Curious is a truly fun, literary podcast. And I gotta be honest, it's one of the few literary podcasts that I pay any attention to whatsoever. So, I was listening to their episode recently on one of the truly lesser known and less well-regarded M.R. James short stories. And they pointed out this audio adaptation that I'm going to bring to you today. Okay, so a word about Black Mass, or The Black Mass, as you will hear at the beginning of this particular episode. Black Mass was a show that started in 1963. It was the brainchild of Jack Nassell, who was the drama and literature director at KPFA in Berkeley, California. It was the first voluntary listener-sponsored non-commercial FM station in the world. Now, Jack suggested the idea of this show to Eric Bowersfield, who taught aesthetics and philosophy in the School of Fine Arts, and had recently begun to do readings of classic and modern literature for the station. Eric wasn't really enthusiastic, but thought it might be interesting to search out some of the best stories of the supernatural by first-rate authors who did not normally write within that genre. Soon, this became an obsession for both of them. Now, apparently, starting in September of 1963, the team they assembled adapted a number of fantastic short stories to radio for the station. They started out with All Hallows by Walter de la Mare. Then the very second one they did was The Ash Tree by M.R. James in December well, that one was in December. There was one in October by J. Anthony West. But they've done things like Bartleby the Scrivener, A Country Doctor by Franz Kafka, Diary of a Madman by Nikolai Gogol, The Haunted House by Virginia Woolf, The Imp of the Perverse by Edgar Allan Poe, The Jolly Corner by Henry James, Nightmare by Alan Wicks, Manuscript Found in a Bottle by Edgar Allan Poe, of course, The Outsider by H.P. Lovecraft, O Mirror Mirror by Nigel Neal, Oil of the Dog by Ambrose Bierce, and a host of others. Now, what we're going to focus on today is that adaptation of the M.R. James story that is not that well thought of called An Evening's Entertainment. Indeed, as the hosts of a podcast, The Curious, pointed out in their show on this particular short story, it is not very well regarded. And when you see the structure of it, and when you see what kind of tale it is, when you listen to the show, you will understand why. It is really not standard Jamesian stuff. It is a little different. It is kind of a, I wonder what this was like kind of story. And in that way, it's very different, but at the same time, for me at least, holds a certain amount of appeal. And clearly for the creators of The Black Mass, it held a certain kind of appeal as well. Now, what pushed the hosts of a podcast, The Curious, to play a snippet of this in their episode devoted to this short story was that, in general, M.R. James's short stories are rather bloodless. You would never call them gory. You would call them frightening. You would call them the kind of thing that gets under your skin and possibly bothers you and causes you to have nasty, disturbed thoughts when the lights go out. But you would never call him a Goremeister. Well, when the Black Mass adapted this story, they decided to, shall we say, toss a bucket of blood into the proceedings. And the descriptions that they have in the story of some of the goings-on near the end of the tale, shall we say, add some detail, some viscera, some organs even, to the descriptions of what goes on. Now, I'm not against that. I find it kind of amusing. And in the context of this adaptation, it being a radio, audio, whatever you want to call it kind of thing, it doesn't stand out and doesn't bother me at all. As a matter of fact, some might say, considering how low down the totem pole this story is set in the realm of James fanboys, maybe this would make it a bit more entertaining or a bit better received by them. Or, who knows, maybe not. Nevertheless, watch out. The end of this story does involve vivid descriptions of bloodiness, goriness, and hell, damn near an entrail pool or two. So here we have it. This is M.R. James's short story, An Evening's Entertainment, adapted by The Black Mass. I hope you enjoy, and I'll be back to talk to you again once this show is over.
Welcome to The Black Mass. Tonight, here is a tale about olden times, based, more or less, on the story by Montagu Rhodes James, An Evening's Entertainment.
Nothing is more common form in old-fashioned books than the description of the winter fireside, where the aged grandam narrates to the circle of children that hangs on her lips story after story of ghosts and fairies, and inspires her audience with a pleasing terror. But we're never allowed to know what the stories were. Here, then, is a problem which has long obsessed me, but I see no way of solving it finally. The aged grandams are gone, and the collectors of folklore began their work too late to save most of the actual stories which the grandams told. Yet such things don't easily die quite out, and imagination, working on scattered hints, may be able to devise a picture of just such an evening's entertainment. Let's see now. There's the fire burning brightly in the large stone fireplace. On the one side sits the squire, exhausted by a long day after the partridges, and replete with food and drink. On the other side, his old mother sits with her knitting, and the children, Charles and Fanny, are gathered about her knee.
Oh, I want to wind Granny's yarn. You did it last time.
No, you did it twice before that.
Well, that doesn't count because...
Oh, now, now, my dears. You must be very good and quiet, or you'll wake your father. And you know what'll happen then.
Oh, yes, I know. He'll be woundy, cross-tempered, and send us off to bed.
What's that? Fie on you, Charles. That's not a way to speak. Now, I was to have told you a story, but if you use such like words, I shan't.
Oh, Granny, please.
Oh, please,
now be...
Shh, 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 shh. Oh, now I do believe you have woken your father.
Hey, look there, Mother, you can't keep them brats quiet.
Yes, John, yes, yes, it's too bad. I've been telling them if it happens again, off to bed they shall go. There now, you see, children, what did I tell you? You must be good and sit still. And I'll tell you what. Tomorrow you shall go a blackberry.
and
if you bring home a nice basket full, I'll make you some jam.
Oh, yes, Granny, do. And I know where the best blackberries are. I saw them today.
Oh, and where's that, Charles, dear?
I know too, Granny. It's in the little lane.
In the little lane that goes up past Colin's cottage.
Charles? Fanny? Whatever you do, don't you dare to pick one single blackberry in that lane. Don't you know? There, how should you? What was I thinking of? Well, anyway, you both mind what I say.
Why, Granny?
Why shouldn't we pick them?
Shh! Remember what I told your father.
But Granny, why?
Very well, then. I'll tell you about it. Only you mustn't interrupt. Here, Fanny, you can take the knots out of this skein for Granny. Now, let me see. Oh, my, sounds like a storm blowing up outside, doesn't it, children? Well, no matter. We're safe and warm inside, aren't we? Well, now, that lane. All this, mind you, happened when I was quite a little girl. That lane was feared even then, and as far back as anyone can remember. And if something that happened to your granny on that lane is any indication, I've often wondered if there was any connection between what I saw and all that about Mr. Davis and his friend that I'm about to tell you.
What did you see, Granny?
Yes, what did you see, Granny?
What did you see?
Well, you know that lane passes near to the top of that hill, where you've seen that old figure cut out in the crag? Well, I was passing along there one evening. I was already late getting home for my supper. But I remember seeing the currant and gooseberry bushes along the side leading to the top of the hill. The berries were ever so ripe and delicious. And before before I realized, I had followed them, tasting one bush, then another, near to the top of the hill. Then I stopped for a moment. I was sure I heard something. Voices, I thought. But I couldn't make out plainly because of the wind. I couldn't make out whether they were coming from the top of the hill or from inside. Somewhere inside the hill itself, voices singing or calling or something. I wasn't frightened at all at first, and I remember walking farther up to see where the sounds were coming from, and the farther up I went, the more it seemed the voices were coming from all around me, from below as well as above. Then, suddenly, you know all those strange old rocks around the top of that hill? Beside one of those rocks. No one believed me when I told the story later, or made out they didn't believe me. Well, what I saw was a hand, a whole arm reaching up from out of the earth. Now, they say that the hill had once been a burial place in ancient times, and that a skeleton arm could very well be unearthed by the rains. But that was no skeleton arm. There was flesh on it, dark and old, and long nails, more like claws. Now you can believe me or not, but I say I saw that arm reaching up out of the earth. And it wasn't a dead arm. When I came nearer, I saw its fingers moving like it was in pain, like it was beckoning me to help it. The rest of it, out of the earth. Now, I told you that I wasn't afraid, and that's true, until I got so close that it almost touched me. But then suddenly, a terrible fear overcame me, and I ran all the way down the hill. And I have never once set foot on that place since. Well, now, it was only a short while after that the events I was going to tell you about began. Careful, Fanny, not too close to the fire with that yarn. That's better. Well, now, up at the far end of that lane, let me see, is it on the right or the left-hand side as you go up? Oh, yes, the left-hand side. You'll find a little patch of bushes and rough ground in the field, and something like a broken old hedge round about, and the kind of gooseberry and currant bushes I told you about growing among it. Well, that means there was a cottage stood there, of course. And in that cottage, there lived a man named Davis. This Mr. Davis lived very much to himself. He didn't work for any of the farmers, having, as it seemed, enough money of his own to get along. But he'd go to town on market days. And one day he came back from market and brought a young man with him. And this young man and he lived together for some long time and went about together. And whether he just did the work of the house for Mr. Davis, or whether Mr. Davis was his teacher in some way, nobody seemed to know. He was a pale young man and hadn't much to say for himself. Well, now, what did those two men do with themselves? Of course, I can't tell you half the foolish things that the people got into their heads. And we know, don't we, that you mustn't speak evil when you aren't sure it's true, even when people are dead and gone. But as I said, those two were always about together, late and early. And there's one walk that they'd take regularly to the place on the hill that I just told you about. And it was noticed that in the summertime they'd camp out there all night. I remember once my father, that's your great-grandfather, told me he had spoken to Mr. Davis and his young friend one evening when he met them on the road. He asked them why they were so fond of going up there.
Why? Why, sir, it's a wonderful old place, and I've always been fond of the old-fashioned things. And when him, my boy here, and me are together there, it seems to bring back the old times plain.
Well, it may suit you, but I shouldn't like to be in a lonely place like that in the middle of the night.
Oh, sir, we don't want for company at such times. That is to say, Mr. Davies and me is company enough for each other. Ain't it so, Master?
Aye. Then there's a beautiful air there of a summer night, and you can see all the country round under the moon.
Oh, it looks so different, seemingly, from what I do in the daytime.
Them bars there, the mounds, all over up there. Now, what would you think was the purpose of them, sir?
Why, I've heard, Mr. Davies, that they're all graves. And I know when I've had occasion to plough up one, there's always been some old bones and pots turned up. But whose graves they are, I don't know. People say the ancient Romans were all about this country at one time. But whether they buried their people like that, I can't tell.
Oh, to be sure. Well, they look to me to be older like than the ancient Romans. And dressed different. That's to say, according to the pictures, the Romans was in armor. And you didn't never find no armor, did you, sir? Not by what you said.
Well, I don't know that I mentioned anything about armor. But it's true, I don't remember to have found any. But you talk as if you'd seen them, Mr. Davis.
Seen them, sir? That would be a difficult matter after all these years. Not but what I should like well enough to know more about them old times and people, and what they worshipped and all.
Worshipped? Well, I dare say I've heard and read about them heathens and their worship. Torture and dances, behavior lewd and ungodly, sacrifices.
Oh, torture and dances, you say?
Sacrifices, you say? Ah. Lewd and ungodly behavior. What manner do you suppose?
Read about them, you say. Heathen, you say.
That was the only time my father had much talk with Mr. Davis. It was around that time that people believed some sort of meetings went on at night time on that hill, and that those who went there were up to no good. And there was known to be others besides Mr. Davis and his young man, I mean. And it was only guessed what really went on.
Dances and torches, Master.
Not so close to the fire with the yarn, Fanny dear. Now mind what I say, else you find yourself going up in flames. Don't stretch that skein so, Charles. Hold it loosely. That's it. Well, now. Well, I suppose it was a matter of 3 years that Mr. Davis and this young man went on living together. And then, all of a sudden, a dreadful thing happened. I don't know if I ought to tell you what it was.
Oh, yes, Granny.
Oh, please, Granny, do, please.
Well, then, you must promise not to get frightened and go screaming out into the middle of the night.
Oh, no, we won't.
No, we won't.
Of course we...
Well, one morning, very early, towards the turn of the year, I think it was in September, one of the woodmen had gone up to his work near the hillside just as it was getting light. What he saw nearly drove the poor man out of his wits. he dropped everything he was carrying and ran as hard as ever he could straight down to the parsonage and woke up old Mr. White.
Parson White.
What is it, man?
Hope.
Quiet, glory be. What's the matter with you?
Oh, Parson, sir, come with me quickly. It's horrible. But you must come with me to see what's been
Miss, will you quiet down and tell me what it is, man? What have you seen?
In the little woods near the hill.
Yes.
Oh, sir, I was going up to my work and I saw it in a clearing. A white thing, what looked like through the mist.
A white
like a man. Like a man, sir. And when I came near, I saw it was a man. Mr. Davies, young man, sir.
What?
Oh, he was dressed in a sort of white gown, sir.
Foolishness.
Yes, he was, and he was hanging by his neck to the limb of the biggest oak. Quite dead, sir.
Glory be.
But the real horrible thing, sir, was his hands.
His hands?
I don't think there were any hands.
What?
No, I couldn't rightly see for the blood, sir. Oh, the blood.
May the Lord bless us and save us. What a sight to behold! A demon's work, if ever I saw on himself before us. His left hand chopped clean off. Oh, if clean we can call it. Maybe cleansed would be the word for it. Cleansed, but for the right. Blood!
Parson, there, just below. I hadn't seen before. Look, sir.
What, oh?
The hatchet! The hatchet on the ground here. Stuck with blood and bits of flesh.
Horrible.
Some flies on it already.
Oh, don't touch it. Don't touch it.
Do you think, sir, that this is a murder?
It's an abomination.
Oh.
An abomination, but I think it's his own act. I think so. You see here, the rock over here.
Huh?
He could have jumped from it and...
Oh.
Yes, it must have been. You can see the saints, the blood... The hand!
Aye, sir, 'tis the hand where he chopped it off. And there it lies. Oh, a sight, sir.
Such a thing.
Oh, and do you see, sir? Do you see it is grasping something?
So it is.
What with all the blood can you make it out? Oh. It seems flesh. It seems part of a living body. Oh, sir, what do you think?
God's mercy. I think it's no living body whose part this be. This is Mr. Davis's man, you say, on the tree.
Ah, yes.
I think we'd best find what we can of Mr. Davis himself.
Oh, yes, sir. We'd better hurry,
Come
I think.
Now.
Come on,
Come.
Sir. The cottage is down there.
Oh,
on the hill, you see, in the field.
Well, now, the door of the cottage stood wide open. And the two men rushed in, not knowing what horrors to expect.
Mr. Davis!
When they came to the little room which served as a parlour...
Oh,
bless us and save us.
What they
look,
saw.
Look.
Oh, they would
horrible.
Not forget the sight for the rest of their lives.
What did they see?
Well... There, in the centre of the room...
The work of the devil's own devil!
...was a table that had been set up as a kind of altar or place of torture, and stretched across, his feet in clamps attached to the foot, and his wrists held at the corners above his head, spread out, naked, facing upwards, lay Mr. Davis. His body almost in shreds from a whip which lay beside him, a tangle of blood and flesh. But the worst of it, oh, the worst of it, the work of the axe. Just below the breastbone, the body had been sliced as far down and torn open, and inside the axe had hacked and slashed away. A part of the spine stuck up, but nothing else was recognizable except the blood. Oh, the blood everywhere. And the strangest thing of all...
Do you see the face, Woodman?
Aye, sir. The most horrible part.
What a mark on it. The eyes staring up.
Oh.
And the mouth open into a terrible grin. Oh! Did you see that twitch?
Yes.
The man can't still be alive and breathing.
And trying to speak, it seemed. No. Both men leaned close to hear and swore later what they heard. Though no one could make sense of it, but they swore they saw the mouth move and the words barely audible come forth.
Again. Again. More. More. Oh, more.
Well, now, Fanny, you're shivering, dear, and so close to the fire. You should fetch a woolly from upstairs, dear.
No, Granny. I'm not cold.
Well, here, you put Granny's shawl round you anyway. That's it, now.
Well, did they bury Mr. Davis?
Did they bury Mr. Davis? Oh, that they did. And his young man together. That very night, but not in hallowed ground, as Parson White would have none of that, but up on the hill. And it was no proper burial either. Some of the men just dug a hole large enough and gathered rocks. Only those few men needed for the task were there. They heard the bell.
It's not coming from the church, Parson.
No, we can all hear. It's coming from inside the hill. For the coming of them of their own.
Aye, Parson. And when we dug the grave, we could swear, but for the darkness and only the candles lighting, we struck things that screamed and pulled themselves deeper into the earth.
We've no place here. This isn't the Lord's ground. Quickly now, throw the bodies in. Right. Cover them with rocks and spread them. And be away now, come on.
And they did. But it wasn't exactly the end of the story.
What happened then, Granny?
What's that sound, Granny? Do you hear it?
Ah, the sound. I'm coming to that. Well, next morning, some of the town folks passing by saw those strange black patches on the road leading up the hill like a trail.
They look to be alive, like.
Oh, how could they be? But they shimmer so.
And when they went closer.
Oh, God preserve us! Flies! Thousands of huge flies!
Why, look what they've been feeding on! Patches of blood from those bodies that were rolled up last night!
Where did they come from? There's never been so many flies about.
Oh, look! Lifting up all along! The sky is black with them!
They found the women, swollen beyond recognition, almost changed in shape, you might say, looking more like them horrible half-animal monsters you see pictures of in ancient books. But almost as fast as they came, they were gone, the blood cleaned from the road, and as some folks swore, taken back by the flies into the hill. Now, Charles.
Yes, Granny.
And Fanny.
Yes, Granny.
Now, I want you to pay special attention to what I'm going to tell you. You remember my saying about them blackberry bushes, not to pick a single blackberry?
Yes,
Granny.
Well, from what I'm going to tell you now, you can judge for yourselves. Now, I said those flies went back into the hill, or wherever they came from, but that wasn't the end of it. Some of them is always seen about up there. And it was one day, while I was courting your grandfather, we were walking up there among those very bushes, and one of them berries, at least I thought it was, seemed to come alive in my hand. I felt the sting that couldn't open my hand. Now I can only say what I know. A numbness went over me. I heard sounds. Then something like a terrible whip. I can't remember all that happened, but your grandfather says he had to hold me from doing things. And it was his own words that the very devil had gotten into me. Later, when I opened my hand and wiped the awful insect away, I couldn't tell whether the blood had come from me or the demon itself. So you both mind what I say, and find your blackberries down in the hollow near the creek. Oh, but look at the time. Off with you, off with you to bed.
Oh, Granny.
Off with you now.
Granny, can we have a candle tonight?
A candle? Certainly not. Now, off with you, and Granny will come and tuck you in later. Go on.
Oh, Granny.
And
Granny,
Charles?
Charles,
don't you frighten your sister up there in the dark, or there'll be no more stories for you.
Mother, what's that?
Oh, I've just sent them off to bed.
Oh, you've been telling them those stories again. You know, Mother, that none of them is true. Where do you get them from?
Well, some of it's true, and the rest... Well, it's like I take hold of something and pull gently, and the rest comes up all of its own.
Well, I couldn't tell you where it comes from. I'm going to my bed, too. You'll see to locking up, Mother. Good night.
Oh, I'll see to it. Good night, Sonny. Yes. I'll just sit a little while longer. Where do they come from? Where?
That was, we hope, An Evening's Entertainment by Montague Rhodes James. Pat Franklin played Granny. Her children were played by Marion Winch and Arlene Sagan. The narrator and Parson White were played by Bernard Mays. Don LePage was Mr. Davis. And Frank Laverdi played Granny's father. Mr. Davis's young man and the woodman and the snoring father were played by Eric Bowersfeld, and the two ladies who were eaten by the flies were Arlene Sagan and Pat Franklin. The technical production for this story was by John Whiting, and the adaptation was by Eric Bowersfeld. And now, good night.
See what I was talking about? The Black Mass did a pretty good job with that story, and they gorified it up. Like I said, it's a little more explicit than your average M.R. James tale is usually. And, well, you know, different strokes for different folks. I thoroughly enjoy that variation on that story, and like I say, it's not one of the more well-regarded M.R. James stories. It's often in the bottom 5th percentile whenever you ask fans or academics or even antiquarian ghost story fanatics And I think that what Black Mass did with it is pretty exceptional. I really enjoy it. Did you catch, I honestly would be impossible not to, homosexual undertones, or maybe they're even overtones, the relationship between the older man and the younger man. Even the way James writes it, it seems, well, let's make sure to say it doesn't seem at all clear that James was trying to insinuate some kind of romantic or sexual relationship between those two characters, but it is quite amusing that, at least in this day and age, there's absolutely no way to listen to the descriptions of their relationship and what they're doing, even before you know for sure that there's some kind of weird supernatural undertaking involving dark and nasty information and knowledge that they shouldn't have. There's just no way to get around the idea that these two guys seem to be really, really fond of each other in a way that might not be the norm. But I don't even know if they're homosexual undertones so much as overtones, really, to a large degree. But I always find that this story absolutely fascinating, and this version of it is probably my favorite way to enjoy an evening's entertainment, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Well, I'll round out this episode with a song here in just a second, but before I go, let me say, if you want to get in contact with me or comment on any of the now 13 episodes of The Bloody Pit, you can drop me a line at thebloodypit@gmail.com, and like I say, any of the episodes you've got any commentary on, please let me know. Now, to close out things, I want to end with a song here that is a recent discovery of mine, although it's a few years old. This is a song by a band called The Triple Tree, which is really just a side project of Soul Invictus frontman Tony Wakeford's, I guess you would describe it as kind of neo-folk in a way, but it's very interesting, and the beauty of it is what this is this song is, of course, M.R. James related. It's called Three Crowns, and of course it is a direct reference to another M.R. James story, which would be A Warning to the Curious. And check out the song. It's quite good. I'm very much a fan of it, and I'm very glad to have discovered it. It's just a chance, just complete chance that I stumbled across this song, and I think that you will enjoy it as well. By the way, did I mispronounce Malevolent all throughout the first part of this podcast? Did I really just... I've got to go back and listen to that. I think I may have. That's really kind of sad. Anyway, here's The Triple Tree with the song Three Crowns. And we will see you next time.
Three crowns for a ghost. Three crowns for a demon. Three crowns for a ghost. Three crowns for a kingdom. Three crowns guard to coast. Three crowns for a demon. Three crowns for a ghost. Three crowns.